And don't forget to join or renew your membership. Just click donate on our website or app and start your monthly contribution to your community radio, KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Stephouse Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Stephouse Internet Services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net. Also, thanks to Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. My guest is scientist Hope Jaron, whose new book is called Lab Girl. It is the memoir of a woman in science. It is also the story of a long-term friendship, and it is a look at plants. In fact, it is kind of a meditation on plant life. Hope Jaron has built three laboratories in which she studied trees, flowers, seeds, and soil. She has received three Fulbright Awards in geobiology and is one of four scientists and the only woman to have been awarded both of the Young Investigator Medals given in the Earth Sciences. She has also taught and pursued independent research at universities around the country, most recently as a tenured professor of geobiology at the University of Hawaii. Hope Jaron, welcome to KBOO. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
As I mentioned in the introduction, your book does several different things, combining memoir with the ongoing theme of observing and understanding plant life on a deep level. Can you talk about what you started out to do in this book?
You know, long ago, I thought I would write a textbook because that's sort of what you do. You go to school, you get your degree, you do some research, you write a bunch of papers, and then you get to a place where you have a broad view across the field. And then you write your textbook and you change the way it's taught to the next generation. So I was moving into the phase of my career where I should sit down and write a textbook. And I tried. I honestly tried for a little while. And then it became clear to me that that's not the book I wanted to write. That wouldn't do justice to what I had learned over the years in total. And it also wouldn't come to the attention of the people that I really had longed to talk to, the people that I wanted to share this stuff with that might or might not find similarities in their own lives. And so I wrote this book, and it's, and you're right, it's not quite a memoir, it's not quite a, but it is, it very accurately reflects what my life is like. You know, I go and do a little science, and then I take care of my kid, and I'm constantly batting back and forth, and I'm thinking about my kid while I'm doing an experiment, and I'm thinking about plants while I'm taking care of my kid, and the whole thing just runs together in a way that makes sense to me and is reflected by the structure of the book. But I think it is a fresh new thing for readers, is what I'm hoping.
Who is that audience that you thought you wanted to reach most?
I'm still waiting to meet them. I mean, it's wonderful. You know, you write a book, and this particular book, I do have to say, was written with so much care. You know, every sentence was scrutinized as to how it would sound to the ear, and whether there would be symmetry in the story, and whether I was dead set against using terminology. I didn't want one word in there that wouldn't appeal to somebody and be accessible to them as a word that they also used when they talked about their lives. And so I was constantly testing every sentence I wrote against, you know, did it live up to that standard? And I thought a lot about this ghost person who might read it someday and what might make them smile and what might trigger their imagination and what might satisfy them as the resolution of some arc or something. And so I do have this ghost image of a reader in my mind. And one of the really exciting things that's happening right now is I'm getting to meet real people. Real actual people are actually reading this. And I get to talk to them and say, hey, did that work? Did it work?
Right. Your book begins with a very moving description of your experiences as a young girl accompanying your father to his laboratory at the community college where he worked. Can you talk about his influence on you?
Yes. I grew up in a rural area, and my dad was a teacher at the only community college in the county. He taught science. Physics was his great love. And he was the scientist in the county, you know, and that was his identity as much as his job. And the county was full of people that had had him in class, and their kids had had him in class. He taught for 42 consecutive years. And we went to the lab with him, you know, just like the family that ran the ice cream shop, you know, the kids were in there scooping ice cream. Well, we went into my dad's lab in the evenings and after school, and he graded papers, and we played with the materials and fixed stuff and put stuff away and took it out and broke it and fixed it and put it away. And my very earliest memories are what it felt like to be in there, what it smelled like. And it was just this very happy, safe place that was special. It was special that I got to go there because it was my dad, and he was very happy there. He loved it there, and we loved it there. You know, I remember thinking from a very young age, you know, when I grow up and I have my lab, we're going to do things this way, and we're going to have this and this. And I thought that was just what you did when you grew up. And I think that was such a tremendous advantage that I always had when I was in these classrooms where I was, you know, the only girl and I clearly didn't fit in or whatever. I had such a strong sense of knowing the fact that I belonged there. I was home, and it didn't matter how people treated me or how well I understood the material or how many mistakes I made, that this was the place where I was home and where I was meant to be. And I still feel that way.
Right. The very title of your book, Lab Girl, kind of implies that it has a great importance to you.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, people, I do get feedback that people don't like the title. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's fascinating. You know, I've even heard people say that it's demeaning, you know, or something diminishing or something like that. And that's fine. You know, that's their opinion. But the fun thing for me is to think about that and think, why? I mean, that's what I was. I was a lab girl. And I was never a tomboy personally. I mean, I was a girl. I like to braid my friend's hair, and I like to jump rope, and I could cook things from scratch, and I thought that was great. And I had to tamp some of that down in order to walk the path that I walked and learn to perform and fit in and succeed in a male-dominated field. And I'm almost 50 years old, and I think it's time for me to call myself a girl, you know? I don't, you know, when am I going to do it if I can't do it now? Because because the part of me that does science is very much as much the girl as it is the woman. And I feel really good about claiming that and putting it in capital letters on the very front.
Mm-hmm. And there's a number of issues that you talked about there that I wanted to get into. One is this whole issue of being a woman scientist. And it had one passage in the book where you said that to be a woman scientist, what you do need, it seems to me, is a strong back and a big heart and a very good friend. Can you talk a little bit more about that quote and just what it was like starting out in the scientific community?
It's tough, and I'm not a tragic story, right? I'm a happy ending. I mean, I've been richly rewarded for everything I've ever tried to do. But, you know, the main rewards I've received, I've given to myself. I love to be there every day. Another day is the reward for every day I spend. And I really do think that's enough. You know, very early on, I realized that certain types of success weren't open to me. I was never going to be the guy with the beard and the tweed jacket smoking a pipe and walking around campus that everybody would recognize as the world's expert in X, Y, or Z. So I had to think very hard about why am I doing this? Why am I doing science? I'm doing it for myself. I'm doing it because I get something out of it every day. And I'm going to very stubbornly keep doing the part that I get something out of, regardless of how many other diversions and administrative concerns and all these kinds of things that come along. I've been very pigheaded about prioritizing the part that I think is worth doing and worth teaching, and the time that you need to spend with yourself and by yourself and with the very few people that get it. And that's a little different than just climbing the scientific ladder for the sake of it.
The required steps to get to certain places in the hierarchy, is that what you're referring to?
You know, I mean, science is just a job in some ways, and it's a holy calling in other ways. You know, it's both at the same time. Sometimes I just have to go in there and label a bunch of stuff, and I do it all day long. And sometimes I go in there and I see something happen that nobody's ever tried to do before. And the fact that something else happens when you do it, I'm the only person that knows that's ever seen that. Like, you know, the world is full of people, and somehow I'm special in what I can do. It doesn't mean that what I'm doing is more important than anything else or whatever, but in those mundane tasks, I find evidence that I'm something, I'm special. And that feeds me. That gives my life meaning. And I want to share how wonderful that is. And I'm trying to put it into words. But I don't know if people know that scientists feel that way about their jobs. And I hope that I can share that joy, you know, and open the door and say, look inside. This is a really great place.
Yeah, you do write about the first, I think it's the first time you experienced that. You're all by yourself, it's the middle of the night, you suddenly have a realization like that and wanting to share it with people.
Yes, and that was, you know, you go to school for many years to learn science, and you do these experiments in the classroom, but it's already been done. You know, if somebody knows what the right answer is, and you're kind of doing it to see if you can get the right answer, which everybody knows is already one thing. And then when you become a PhD student and you start doing research, you're doing experiments that nobody knows what the answer is. Nobody knows if it'll even work or give you an answer. And once you get an answer, you can't automatically assume that you're right. And so it's a very different experience. And the first time I really completed that and learned something new, it was the middle of the night, and I had to wait for the sun to come up for hours, and I had nobody to share it with. And I was so excited, and I thought it was so wonderful, but I had to wait. And I remember watching the sun come up and using that time to think about how, you know, in addition to being small and insignificant and one of billions of people, that I was existentially special, you know, that there was something truly unique about what I knew and what I could do and what was in my brain. It wasn't a huge discovery. It wasn't a cure for cancer or anything like that, but it was so clear to me that everything I'd ever done, you know, every test I'd ever studied for and every machine I'd ever changed the oil in, and it was all worth it. It was all that's what it was for.
I'm speaking with Hope Jaron. We're talking about her new book, Lab Girl. This is Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. As I mentioned earlier, another theme that is in the book is this friendship between you and Bill. You meet him when you are, I think, a graduate assistant in a class. The class requires students to dig holes, speaking of repetitive activities. Can you describe your first interaction with him?
It was a great class, and you basically just travel around, and you can do this yourself. It's really fun. You just stop somewhere, go outside, and dig. You know, there's everywhere you go, there's stuff that you can point to, and it's alive. It's a plant or a piece of grass. It's a living thing. And if you dig down deep enough, you'll get to rock. You'll get to something you can point to, and it's not alive. it's a rock or whatever. And everything in between is soil. And everywhere you go, the soil is different. All you need is a shovel or even a dull knife. A butter knife works in a lot of places. And you'll see different colors. You'll see, maybe you'll be lucky enough to see bugs and worms crawling around down there. And you'll start to notice that sometimes it's wet, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's not. Sometimes the more you look, the more you see. So this was a course where you basically drive a lot and you dig a lot of holes and you just keep looking at them and looking at them. And I started to notice that there was somebody that acted a little different. You know, his hole was a little deeper and a little more perfect around the edges. And he was off by himself outside of the group. And he was able to do it in half the time it took everybody else. And then he took the rest of that time while he was waiting for everybody to dig another hole and see if it was the same. You know, this was somebody quietly doing it on the side. And I knew that I was seeing, and sometimes I have this feeling, I knew that I was seeing something that if you didn't look closely, you'd miss it. Something special was there. And if you didn't look closely and pay close attention, you might miss it. And that person was Bill. And I don't know, people talk about love at first sight. I mean, maybe it was collaboration at first sight or some scientific version of that. But I just knew that this was somebody special and that if we brought him into the lab, that any experiment or anything I brought him into, he would make it better, period. And that's been true now for 20 years mm-hmm. or more.
And he's a somewhat eccentric person. I mean, for a while he lives in the building where your lab is. I mean, sort of not exactly secretly, but he does find a way to live in the building because he doesn't really have a home. And other aspects of being a little different than the average person that would be working in a lab.
Yeah, I mean, he's special. You know, he made it his life. And we ran out of money. And he's indestructible, and he survives. And the fact that we ran out of money, and you know, we didn't know what to do, and I barely had a job, and it was such a horrible struggle that he never saw any of those struggles as a reason to quit. It was just like, I don't know. I mean, as bad as things ever got, he never talked about quitting, and I didn't either. It's just how we've lived now for decades. And I think there are people like this in the world, you know, that there are these people that are made of something stronger than steel. And once they give themselves to a goal, there's something stronger than fate kicks in and it happens. And I don't know if readers know that there are people like that in science, because this isn't somebody that's, you know, going to end up on the Discovery Channel. That's not his thing. It's somebody that if you don't look carefully, you're going to miss. More than anything, you know, he deserves a book. And I tried so hard to do justice to what a hero this person is. And time will tell, but I did my very best. And you can hear from my voice how much, you know, this is
meaningful.
Yeah.
And has he read the book?
People ask, he has the book. You know, he has a copy of it. We live it every day. He'd much rather live it than talk about it or tell about it or whatever. I mean, I think his attitude is, why would I read about my life? I can remember it as well as you can. Let's go do something. Let's go do some of this stuff. It's not what we are about, I think. I don't know. He has a copy.
Funny. You even say at some point he's your alter ego. Is that what I read?
Yeah, I have a whole descriptive page talking about how I can't describe it. Mm. I think you have to read the whole book. But I think people have special people in their lives that they can't really put their finger on what the relationship is. They also can't imagine their lives without this person in it.
Another theme that comes up in the book is, and I don't know how you describe manic depression or bipolar issues, which term or what term you like to use there, but it's a theme that kind of, for the reader, it kind of creeps up on you because when you're reading the earlier parts of the book, it sort of almost becomes natural that you pull these all-nighters and, you know, intensively work on things, but then there's a point where this becomes problematic.
Yeah.
What was that like to write about?
I think that's exactly what you just talked about, how it appears in the book like that. That was very intentional because I think that's how it appears in your life as a tendency that becomes unmanageable associated with a certain age of development. From what I understand, that's a fairly common clinical presentation. How to write about it. You know, when you write a book, writing a book is a funny thing. I think everybody should write a book because everybody's got a story and it helps you make sense of your life. I mean, before I wrote this book, I'd done all this stuff and we'd lived all these places and we did all this crazy stuff. And what did it all mean? It was just this chaotic mess. And then I wrote the book and I kind of feel like my life makes sense now in a way that it didn't before. And maybe who knows, maybe it'll flop and that's the only thing we get out of it. And if so, that's enough. But writing a book is also a funny endeavor in that nobody can sit down with you and say, yes, go write it. That is absolutely worth your time. And I guarantee you that something will come of it. you can't judge a book until it's done. And at that point, you've already spent all the time, etc. So there was a long period where I was writing and writing. And until it's a book, you don't know. Right? So I finally had to say, I just have to get this out. I have to just write it down and do my best. And my only comfort one day when people do like it or they don't like it, my only comfort at that point will be to be able to say myself that I did this as accurately and as authentically as I could, that I was as honest and true to my experience as I possibly could be with words. And so that's what I did. And there's a few passages in the book, and that's one of them that I wrote once. They formed in my head. I could see it, and I pushed it out through my fingers. I made the screen look like what was in my head. And when I showed it to somebody, they said, bang, and it never changed. None of all the editors ever suggested one change. And that part is one of those parts, and it just exists. Now my choice is, am I going to fold up that paper and shove it in a drawer, or am I going to try to show it to the world? And honestly, I don't know if showing it to the world is the right choice. What I did know was that shoving it in the drawer was the wrong choice. I knew that that was the wrong thing to do. So here we are. And I think you count on the reader, that the reader sees it for what it is and is willing to forgive you for your flaws and embrace what they see that's good. I'm also concerned about the message that you see now and again that being bipolar or being manic depressive or whatever is somehow adaptive toward brilliance, or, you know, it gives you a better imagination, or it gives you some kind of fire that allows you to do something special or something like that, which I'm very personally, based on my own experience. You know, if you watch somebody you care about go through this, really go through this, there's no way under heaven you can stand there and say this is somehow good for them, really. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to show that.
You say that the most important thing you know about science, you learned one summer in Colorado, I think, that experiments are not about getting the world to do what you want it to do. You learn to study plants in a new way, not from the outside, but from the inside. Is there something else that you want to mention about that way that you wanted to understand plants and write about and have people understand?
Right. And that's a way of thinking that has been so rewarding for me. And it motivates everything I do. It motivates the way I teach in the classroom. And it comes from very, very simple principles that being alive on planet Earth is solving a problem. Anything that's alive can die. And every day that it doesn't die, it has solved the problem of death. So in doing that, it has to solve that problem of death over the long term. Every organism, and it doesn't matter if you're an ant or a fish or a person or a plant or a mushroom or a bacterium, every single living thing has to do five things. It has to grow. It has to maintain that growth. It has to store resources for future use. It has to defend itself. And it has to reproduce if the species is going to make it on the planet. And so if we think about most biological activities are oriented toward successfully accomplishing one or two of those five goals at any given time. And that applies to plants. So if we think about a tree standing there and really look at it, if I think about what it has to do to grow, what it has to do to defend itself from all the things that want to eat it and it can't run away from, what it has to do to reproduce. If you think about the oak tree in your yard, what if every single one of those acorns turned into a tree? We'd be up past our eyeballs in trees. Mm. So trees have this funny thing where they make all these offspring and they're almost never really successful at it, you know? And the more I thought about something standing there with the same job as mine, but accomplishing it in such a vastly different way, it helped me systematize, or it helped me focus in and study on how different they were, as opposed to confirming what somebody else already thought, or what I already knew, or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the best I can put it into words.
Mm-hmm. This might be a good time for us to hear a little excerpt from the book that pertains to plants. And I was particularly intrigued because it talks about almost, I don't know if communication is the right word, but I don't know. Is communication the right word?
Absolutely. So it's interesting, too, because of the choice of words. You know, there's the scientific word, and there's the word that people use. And the only difference between those two words is we can share the one word, and the other word is within the domain of scientists like me, right? And so I've broken that rule a million times in this book, is mm-hmm. that the two words, you know, communicate versus signal with secondary metabolites, or, you know, what is the right way to say this biologically? I have over and over again chosen to say that the trees are communicating. They talk to each other. They tell each other things. And it's interesting to watch people react to that. They police that language. Is very policed. Mm. You know, you're anthropomorphizing, you're da-da-da-da-da. And what I really just did was break your rule and used a word that somebody can understand, a shared word, instead of one of ours. So that was a bit of a digression, but let me read
Okay.
Yes. In the war between plants and insects that has been raging for 400 million years, both sides have had their casualties. In 1977, the State University's Research Forest in King County, Washington, was utterly ravaged by an insect attack. Tent caterpillars led the charge. They are brutal and insatiable warriors and were able to completely defoliate several entire trees and fatally damage many more, before they triggered a crash in the local tree population across many broadleaf species. We all know that it is possible to lose a battle and still win the war, and nowhere do we find this to be more true than in the history of trees. So I go on to tell about how trees essentially are able to warn each other when an insect attack comes. This particular species in this particular experimental forest in King County, Washington, they were able to show that trees far away, kilometers away, were making these defense compounds that were unpalatable to the tent caterpillars, even though they'd never been exposed to them. And so there was data and observation saying that, you know, somehow the warning had been sent. And 20 years later, scientists developed the molecular tools to elucidate the exact way that the genes had been turned on by the volatile compounds that arrived, etc. But this is a wonderful example of something that trees can do, that they need to do, and that they get great benefit from doing, that you maybe didn't know about.
It's a fascinating book. It's fun to read on so many levels, so I appreciate you being willing to talk about it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's great to be here. Thank you.
I want to let people know again, I have been speaking with Hope Jaron. We've been talking about her book, Lab Girl. If you missed part of this interview or want to hear it again, it will be available on our website later today. That's kboo.fm. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Seattle Theater Group, presenting astrophysicist Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Dr. Tyson will explore science as portrayed in pop culture, and tickets and information for his September 20th show are available at portland5.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the other September 11th, Not Forgiven and Not Forgotten, a film screening on Sunday, September 11th at People's Food Co-op in Portland. In 1973, Chile experienced a coup by right-wing forces led by Augusto Pinochet. No forgiving, no forgetting is often painted on walls or written on protest signs in Chile. This film screening includes three short documentaries that focus on the student movement, women's rights, and indigenous land reclamation. The filmmaker will be present to facilitate a conversation about what we can learn from these movements. Again, that's the other September 11th, Not Forgiven and Not Forgotten, a film screening Sunday, September 11th at 7:30 at People's Food Co-op, 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
We'll be right back.